Welcome, and you're listening to Cued Up Media Group production of Geekologist Radio, a division of the Ninja Pancake family of podcasts. And meow.
Shut up and sit down.
Hey, it's Christopher, and welcome to Geekologist Radio, sponsored by Loot Crate by Cade Six. where we take you through our queue into our gaming systems and ride the hype train from the past into the future. Let's introduce everybody for this evening. Let's start out with Brandon.
What's going on, guys?
Next we have Mr. Nash.
Hey, everybody.
And finally, Mr. Saint.
You can tell by our intros that it's been a slow week in terms of news and activity. Not a lot of movies, not a lot of TV shows doing stuff, not a lot of trailers. But we still give you a full episode, and we'll still give you a lot of energy. But you'll be surprised. We still are going to talk about a lot of stuff. It's just not the
There's been a lot of stuff, just not a lot of good stuff. Some okay stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why don't we start and get into our queue?
We switched round and round till half past dawn. There was 57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing on.
Okay, I seen Get Out. Anybody else has seen it? No. A bunch of head shankings, no. It's going to be really short what I got to say about it, because it has to be, and I'll explain why. Get Out broke in the news, obscure 20-year-old record held by the Blair Witch Project for the highest grossing debut for a writer-director. It's a 20-year-old record, and it broke it. Good job on Jordan Peele. And I should stop right there. I'm just going to put a quote from the director in on why you shouldn't say anything more, because the less you know about this movie going in, the better it will be for you. Director Jordan Peele: I knew that the only way to make this movie work, besides getting the tone right, was that the plot would have to reveal the judgments and the presumptions we would have to make about the movie are in fact our presumptions. The movie is in fact something you're not expecting to be. When you do that, the audience is forced to look at themselves and say, why did I assume this was going on when there's been breadcrumbs this whole time? It's actually something completely different. That's his quote. That's his quote. I completely agree with it. This movie, 9 to 9.5 out of 10 for me. Loved it. It's not a horror, it's a thriller, and it is pitch perfect. It's fantastic. Loved it.
So it compares to Pitch Perfect?
That's the twist. That's the twist.
You know how I love my singles.
I saw the trailer for this, and it actually looked really good, but I'm not a big horror thriller guy, so like I would watch this probably on iTunes. Like I'd catch it once it hits video. But it does look interesting for sure.
Exactly. And it's a thriller because it has to be to tell its story. That's the things I don't like about horror movies. If you're just trying to like scare me to make me scared, I'm not buying that at all. This one is a thriller because it has to be to make its points. And it has a few times I jumped, I don't scare easily, but at the most part, it was just a good thriller. Yeah. That was it.
Is this a good thriller? Like almost like Signs?
Oh, no. Better than Signs. Signs was more...
I was just trying to use it as a
baseline. Yeah. If I think of a comparison to it, I'll say it later, but I can't think of something to compare it to at this point in time.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've been dying. I'm going to see tomorrow Boss Baby. So I can't wait. I know, Brandon, you've seen it. Tell us a little bit about Boss Baby.
Honestly, 6 out of 10.
That's pretty good than from what I was seeing.
That's good. It's a kids movie. It's a good
6 out of 10. I mean, like all the funny parts you see are in the trailers. 90% of all the funny parts in the movie are in the trailers.
Ooh, that's no.
That bueno. That's the bad part about it. That is why it got a 6 out of 10.
Spider-Man.
I was rolling laughing. The thing I liked about it most is there is a bajillion throwbacks to everything else, like back in time. So there's like one for 300, there's one for Voltron, and a bunch of other different shows and different media that I loved when I was growing up.
So that's kind of cool. It's a callback for adults. Gives you an opportunity to listen to something while you're taking your kids.
Right.
Yeah. I know my kids have been super excited about seeing this.
It hits you right in the member berries. It's like, exactly. One member berry shot. Another member berry shot.
Hang on now. You've been dying to use that since last week.
I know. I missed so many opportunities last week. I was listening. I was like, oh, I missed it. I missed again. Dang it. I should have used that word.
Brandon's reaction feels like a member berry graze. Like it's just a straight graze. Like it actually doesn't hit you right there. It just grazes past.
You know, but a graze to the member berries can be like, it can take you to the ground. Just saying.
It actually hurts worse.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. If it actually makes contact, if it just hits the unshorn hair, then it's not going to be bad.
Oh no. Well, there's a show that I've been dying to watch actually, and I've heard a lot about Magicians. What do we know about Magicians season 1 and 2? Because give me the escalator pitch.
It is okay. Basically, it's Hogwarts. It's the adults' version of Harry Potter. Like now, I know a lot of us like Harry Potter, but this is straight up. Like, if I was to meld Game of Thrones with Harry Potter, that's what The Magicians is.
Oh, no. Cajun has a strong... You said Game of Thrones. He immediately switches
it. No, because I've seen the first couple episodes of it.
And, yeah, you got... Yeah, you cannot compare it to the first couple of... I saw the first episode, and then I saw the second one, and I was like, nah. But Khan... this is a shout-out to Young Khan... this was one of the things he kept saying that we needed to watch. So I watched it, and then I pulled a full Fouts. I watched season one in 2 days, and then I'm caught up to date right now with the new season in 1 day. So we have 2 episodes left in this current season, and the current season honestly is by far way better than the first season because it takes place. Like, I mean, Break Bills is Hogwarts.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, essentially, but it's
Hogwarts for like college kids. It's basically college Hogwarts. Kids out of their high school or college age kids almost, they go to
this
place for magic college.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that they do in it though is they bring in a lot of pop culture into it. So they actually quote things from Game of Thrones. They even call people muggles from time to time. Like they use Harry Potter verbiage in some of the things because they make fun of a few things. But it's not.
That's horrible. I'm sorry.
It's actually done really well. It's done really well when they do it. Like when they do it, I'm like, oh, I'm like, that actually works. Trust me, I'm protective of the Potterverse. Chris,
the thing that you're saying that's dissuading me is the fact that season 2 is better than season 1. If I can't get through season 1.
Oh no, you'll get through after get you
Wait
get
a second. How many seasons of Walking Dead have you watched?
I've trudged through about 3. I've watched 7.
So you get through like episode 3, 4 is when it really starts getting its legs and it'll draw you in because there is a villain in season 1 that at first it screams Voldemort. I'm just gonna say it. The villain screams Voldemort. But when
I could tell they were hinting at it in the first 2 episodes. They were hinting at something, but I couldn't tell what was more there.
But when you get drawn into the storyline, you find out how sick and twisted it is. Like it gets really dark real quick, and then you're pulled in, and then they like all of a sudden you're like, okay, well I said I compared it to Game of Thrones is because it starts to make you feel like oh, this villain's I hate this guy. And then you're like, well, I see what he's doing. I understand. They tilt you on that side and say, hey, you know, you're going to start to feel for this guy. And
right.
And then it goes back and forth. And season 2, kind of a similar thing, but completely different. It's in its own right. And it's, Season 2 has so many stories going around that I can't wait to see what they're going to do in the future with it because the special effects are really good. Whereas you talk about bad CG in The Walking Dead, that's not a problem on this whatsoever. It's beautiful. Because I'm watching it in 4K and it is, you know, in 4K your makeup effects and everything have to be spot on because you're going to see if there's a crease and stuff and you don't see anything in this.
If you're close enough to the screen.
Does the plotline from season 1 continue into season 2? Like,
yes.
I mean, does it transition?
It's an exact, like, season 2, season 1, could be one season, one full season. The One thing is I like it. You can tell that this, even though it says a sci-fi original, you can tell that sci-fi picked this up. This was more meant for, like, say, Stars, HBO, something like that.
Was it graphically? Okay.
Language and violence. It definitely is meant for a more, for a mature audience. Now, if you watch it streaming on Netflix right now, you can catch the first season on there, and it is, it has all the cursing and nothing's cut. Now watching it on sci-fi, they say shit, but the F-bombs are, they bleep out the middle of it. So it gets a little silly with that sometimes.
Yeah. Cause it's a broadcast network. Yeah.
Yeah. You might as well not even say it. Oh, that's a bummer.
But even still, I've been glued. Yeah. I have been glued to my TV watching this stuff. And like, I even got my wife interested in it, and she doesn't get interested in anything other than like HGTV most of the time. So
I might give it a few more episode tries to see if it hooks me in. But yeah, the first ones just did not catch me. I just could not get into it at all. Like this is to me it was a crappier Hogwarts. But like you said, if it starts slow and picks up later,
it does.
It needs to, because it is a lot of setup at the beginning.
It is a lot
of payoff.
And
we're talking hour episodes too.
Yes, they're hour episodes.
Okay.
See, or 40. Yeah, 45. Yeah.
Khan told me the first time he was on, he talked about magicians. I watched like the first episode and I was like, eh, and I let it sit in my queue. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, you know, the second time he was on, he was talking about that in Yoga Hosers. I went back and watched Yoga Hosers as well. It's a good, if you like Kevin Smith, it's good.
How long's the seasons? Are they around like 10 or 12 episodes?
13 episodes.
Okay, that's not that bad.
Yeah. So you can, I mean, like I said, I never sit down and just watch TV, and I blaze through. I was like, I got to get caught up because I don't want them to, you know, go off of on demand. So.
Yeah. So.
So.
Speaking of. Well, not speaking of anything, let's just talk about really crappy movies. I'm sorry. I'm going to offend a lot of people when I say that. My anticipation of Ghost in the Shell was that this movie was going to flop. I thought this thing was going to flop. I apologize.
So did you like it? Did you not like it?
I liked it, but I liked it hoping. I saw it with my son. He had a big issue with the same thing that when I watched it, I'm like, okay. They do some makeup effects on Scarlett Johansson to make her look a little bit like she could be part.
Oh.
And I was like, that's not good. That's not good at all. I'm like,
we're gonna try to make you look Asian. Is that what we're going?
When there's Asian actresses you can cast.
Yeah, and now here's the problem.
That is literally whitewashing the face.
Now
of the paper.
I can't. I won't say it. Like, it depends. Lord. If I was to explain a little more into it. One of the reasons why it would have done okay had they not chosen to do a certain key thing that they brought in to the fact the whitewashing turned into it actually a big part of the storyline, which was a bad move.
Let's meme ourselves.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's bad. Oh my gosh.
But like I was at first when I watched it, like I was entertained. However, it feels like it's just like it's a promo. Like it feels like a pilot to his TV series, because you could tell that they wanted to go in and do the full. Like they wanted, because they mixed in elements of the animated series versus the film, and it doesn't necessarily feel like it's a full story. Like it's a perfect setup. Like I'm gonna have a bunch more movies. Well, guess what? They're looking at taking a $60 million hit right now. Now I liked it because of the special effects and other things, but I liked it thinking that I was going to get to see the rest of the story. Knowing that the fact that more than likely that's not going to happen, I would only rank it like a 5 out of 10. Because of the fact that by a studio is not going to bank anymore on making more of these, it would be a mistake.
Yeah, when they're already losing as much as they're losing.
Right? Yeah, and so it's a hard, but it's...
Yeah, it's estimated to lose between 60 and 100 million. That's crazy high. Yeah. Yeah. You don't get to make a second movie when you lose that much.
No, I mean, but the fight scenes are great. My son thoroughly enjoyed Scarlett Johansson on screen as he,
who wouldn't?
Yeah, I know. My wife told me, she goes, she's like, okay, she goes, now you're gonna, she goes, as soon as Magic Mike 3 comes out, you're taking me. I'm like, but
so
yeah, no.
Looking back,
from a guy who knows a lot about Magic Mike.
Yeah.
You know the full backstory. I believe a few episodes ago we talked about this.
We did. Yeah, we did.
Yeah. So looking back on March, guys, we had all these movies come out in March. We're like, this is going to be the best one. This is going to be the worst one. Any surprises in terms of quality of movie being higher or lower or anything in March?
I expected more from Boss Baby.
Okay.
I expected like more funny scenes that weren't in the trailer. Is probably what it is, but I mean, the movie was good, but I thought it was going to be better with more funnier parts in it that were not seen in the trailer.
All right.
I didn't expect Power Rangers to be as hard hitting as it is and to do as well as it's doing. That's one of the things I didn't expect, and like a lot of people, like they're full on for six movies.
Yeah. Well, it did better than I thought too, because I thought it was going to be, and the critical acclaim of it is what I thought it was, a hot mess that doesn't know what it is, but
fans are loving it because they can connect. Yeah. Everybody can connect with the character and stuff like that, and it's been like, my brother was hoping to like it, but he was kind of hesitant. He went and saw it. First thing he calls me up, he goes, okay, you need to take your son to see it, because he goes, it's great for people who are the underdog. Who are feel like they're the underdog, and that they'll really connect with the characters. And that's what the fans have basically been saying with it. Critically, yeah, they're bashing for some of the things, like in the last, because it gets rushed in the last.
Yeah,
last
there's,
little
no,
bit.
There's a lot of, they, no, it's way more than that. They pan it on. But at the same time, fans of the Power Rangers series have been liking it, so that's good. So, Chris, what were your expectations in March? Any surprises?
No surprises, aside from the fact that when people get excited about a movie like Logan and it actually hits where you want it to hit,
right,
and does exactly what you want it to do, it comes off as a surprise, because I think oftentimes our expectation levels of movies or games are so high and we're let down so often. And then when something sticks the landing, it's a surprise to me, because that never happened.
It definitely stuck that landing too.
Right. In terms of all the movies that came out this month, and I didn't get to see them all, that was it. Like, Logan hit exactly where I thought it was going to hit. Really strong, critically, financially successful. For me, I thought we had seen every trailer of every movie that was going to do great this month. For me, Get Out was a surprise. I'm glad my wife picked that one. We were picking movies to go see last weekend. She said, I want to see Get Out as the number one I want to go see. And I was like, yeah, I'll go watch that one too. And thinking back on March, that one wasn't on our radar at all. Everything else was on our radar. That one wasn't. And for me, that was a surprise to have all these big movies come out, and a surprise to break records and do as well as it did. Damien?
Con was another one that I was glad to see do as well as it did, and to have the acting be as strong as it was in it. It's something that I thought was a really cool thing. It was Logan and Con.
You said Con quite a few times there.
Yeah, I know.
Kong's Kong.
Kong's Kong.
Hong Kong 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 School
Island. Well, it's because I kept saying, I was saying Young Con earlier, and so it just kind of came into the speech there. It's the same thing that happened when I did the with the Michael Fassbender, you know. It happens.
There are very few shows or movies or things that come out where they hit you and you don't expect it, and it comes kind of out of nowhere. And I know, Fouts, you watched all 13 tapes. I watched all 13 tapes.
I've seen one tape.
One tape of 13 Reasons Why.
Yeah.
I cannot express enough. And I don't really want to get into a whole lot of it, because I still have some thoughts that I'm kind of unpacking on it. But it's a show for me that just kind of hit right in the feels. I didn't expect it. Shout out to Lady of Legend. She's the one who threw out the suggestion of the show, and it was really, really good. It started out as something where I'm like, oh, I'm just going to watch an episode, and then it turned into three episodes. And then by the time my Tuesday hit, it was seven episodes, and I don't binge anything. Like, I don't binge anything. And so this movie was just, or the TV show was just the right amount of talking about a subject that was kind of, that's taboo and kind of tainted. And it puts a version of realism on it. And it also talks about life in kind of like in real terms, as opposed to a glamorized version of it. And that's, I think that's the part for me. Depression and suicide is a very, very quiet subject. And I think that they tackled it in a way that was very professional and it can reach a lot of people.
So this right off the gate, I just watched one episode today because I knew we were going to talk about it and I'd seen a bunch of y'all streaming through it and it looked like I didn't watch any trailers on it. And then I pop it in and then right away I'm liking it. But it hit me right away. Like, that is almost exactly like My Suicide. My Suicide was a movie that I saw South by Southwest quite a few years back, and it got released in theaters as Archie's final project. It was one of these really low budget things. You didn't see much about it. If you had to watch it, you had to go to like the obscure theater for it. Highly, highly, highly recommend watching this movie if you like 13 Reasons Why or if you like to deal with mature subjects in a mature way. It deals with it like this one does it with the cassette tapes. This one does it from more of his perspective through video. And it's his storytelling of his life, and it's his final video project, and he's a video editor. It is an extremely well-written movie, highly recommend Archie's Final Project if you like 13 Reasons Why. And it hit me right away, and I was hooked right in. Even the art direction was the same at the start. I was like, that's awesome. Because they were obviously inspired by this movie right away because so many things hit exactly like it. But at the same time, I was like, if you're doing a TV show about this great little indie movie, I'm all in.
As a father of a 16-year-old daughter, this series hit me really, really hard. It goes into depth, if you don't know, about a young girl who commits suicide. And
it lets you know that right away. It lets you know that right away, so we're not spoiling anything. That's like...
First opening line.
First scene, you know this.
Her tape saying, by the way, I'm pretty much dead, and
This is a book from 2004, so this is not... This is a New York Times bestseller that has made its way around to being converted into a series. So this has been around for a while.
But this series just hit me really hard, just being a father of a 16-year-old daughter. If you are a parent, especially of a daughter, then I highly recommend you watching this. I honestly, as tough as it was to finish the last couple episodes because of the things that go on and all the things that entail for this young girl, I still give the series probably a 9 out of 10.
I agree wholeheartedly. I was so invested in this. And the fact, Cajun, when you talked about the fact that that movie, like, I'm kind of at a point right now where nothing I'm watching hits me like that. And so it's one of those rare things where you watch something and you don't anticipate it having emotion and it does. And then you're like, okay, now what do I do with that? And so now I'm looking for something to kind of fill that up. And if I'm able to watch something that even hits on the same premise or mark, I'd be looking for that because it's like playing a great game where you're like, okay, now what do I do? Because I don't have anything that fills that void or that need. The one thing that I appreciate about this show is it speaks to what is my truth, because Hannah's version of the truth versus everybody else's version of the truth is all their version of the truth. You know what I mean? And so you don't know what somebody is going through or what another person is feeling until you see their point of view, which is why I appreciate the fact that it gave credence to each person's tape, because it gave Hannah's view and it gave the other person's view on those tapes. And so just because your point of view is one thing and their point of view is another thing, it doesn't mean any of that could have stopped anything. However, it gives you perspective on it, which I think is something that I didn't have maybe prior to watching this, and now after watching this, I've gained.
Yeah, so around this time last year, Netflix dropped a show that a lot of people couldn't get their eyes off of, Stranger Things. It had a very 80s feel to it. This thing has a 80s feel, although it's filmed in modern times. And it was a show that people just started binging like this, couldn't put down, and couldn't stop talking about. And came out of nowhere. Wasn't one of the big shows I was expecting. And from the buzz I'm hearing from you guys, being one of the early adopters of Stranger Things, I can definitely see this being Stranger Things 2.0 for Netflix, where this cast is going to be on all the talk shows. People are going to start talking about it and having it be an important social topic in modern times. Stranger Things was just good. It didn't make social commentary happen. This is going to make social commentary happen about serious topics. And I think that's even more important. And so I really hope it hits as hard as it does with other people as well.
Anything that can hit topics on depression and stuff like that. I mean, it's the community that, I mean, our podcast goes out to. I mean, we've talked about it how many times, how just this podcast is important to us because we've gone through different fight depression or have fought it in the past. And this is something that, you know, it helps. It's an outlet. And, you know, seriously, always knowing that there is always someone that you can get in contact with. There's the suicide helpline.
Yeah. And one of the members of Uprising just requested us to put a bigger tier support channel in our Slack for that reason. I don't know if it was for this show, but it just came up very recently. So we already had some support channels. We're just talking about how we're going to actually package it and have it set up so we can help support each other when our fellow Guardians need it.
Takethis.org just got full support. They're the group that go to all of the cons, specifically like the PAXs, and they have AFK rooms where people who are dealing with things can have a safe place or can have somebody to conversate with. This isn't a topic that's being silenced anymore, and it's pushed out. Kudos to Netflix for having the ability to hit on topics, not just even specifically this topic, but they're willing to take challenges when it comes to specific things that are a little taboo. And as long as there's a good story to be told, they're willing to take on that challenge. And so, again, I can't say enough about this. I've been shouting literally from the mountaintops from the moment I started watching this in our Discord, on Facebook, on Twitter, like this is a show to watch. And, I actually hope, and they set this up at the end, the non-spoiler for anybody for season two, I really hope they don't. I really hope they just drop it here and just let it be, because this is one of those things where I don't want to see a season two. I just kind of want to let it be what it is, because I think it has more impact for what it is than if we try to extend it farther. I know this is a Selena Gomez produced item, and so with that carries a little bit more weight, so she can maybe open up doors to open more seasons because of that. And it does open up an end that is not even involved as part of the book, which kind of makes me a little nervous, because I think what they did with the book is they expanded a lot of these characters. A lot of the characters that you see on each one of these tapes were very one-note characters. This was the jock. This was the person that was, you know, the one that liked music and blah, 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 blah. And instead of doing that, they expanded each character and made them full episodes to the point where, quite honestly, some of the 13 episodes could have been maybe even more contract and could have made two of the people be in one episode, but they wanted to make it coincide with the 13 tapes. So all in all, again, really great show. I don't want to over talk about it because it's one of those things kind of like the Get Out, but that I feel like you need to be able to be a part of it as opposed to know exactly what the story is about. And so if you know the theme, it helps you, because there's a lot of people where that is too much. And so it's good to know that this is about suicide and this is going to talk about depression. If this is something that's going to be too overwhelming for you, maybe this is not the show for you, or maybe you should be watching it in a company that gives you support or comfort while you're watching the show. So as hard as it is in transition from a serious subject like that, we'll move on into The Walking Dead season finale. There's some mixed feelings on this season finale, to the point where some of us are about ready to, walk the other direction.
Hashtag. That's right.
I don't know, because eeny, meeny, mighty, mo, a tiger catches you by the face. He catches him in the face. A tiger does it more than once. It was great.
Apparently you speak tiger. You can just tell the tiger who to eat and who not to eat.
It's a magic tiger.
That was hokey for me.
Come on now. Come on.
However, I did call it on an aspect of the fact that it wound up still being that whole trope where they're backed into a corner and then here comes around the people coming to rescue him. It was not who I thought it was going to be, though. I thought those. Huh? I thought everybody was going to be there. Like, I thought Oceanside was going to come in and be the ones to rescue. Oh, you thought Oceanside was kind of chain. Yeah, I thought they were going to be the ones that were going to be the cavalry. But instead, it wound up being the Kingdom and Hilltop.
No tension in this show. No tension in this episode for me whatsoever. No emotional ride for me at all. Sasha's decision. I didn't feel anything.
Did you? But that's not.
I'm like, oh, it's Sasha. I she's already planning on doing this anyway. Like, okay, and like, does she really think this is gonna affect anything?
But
so I didn't feel any connection there at all.
But you had did you not like at least what I thought that it made a kind of a nice send off for Abraham. Like I felt like it was a good. I felt that that was a nice send off for Abraham.
It was nice seeing Abraham again. Like that was fun.
We already,
but like I've already seen the story was like, dude, really? Yeah, I agree with Cajun. It's like we already sent him off, and the story with Sasha was like, why this is drawing out a season finale by an extra half an hour for the sake of drawing it out for an extra half an hour.
Exactly. Yeah. There was those extra scenes with Sasha and Abraham.
I can't argue.
Slow drama. To basically say, we're going to kill this person. We're going to kill Sasha. Yep. There's the only reason we're giving you this emotional stuff right now is we're going to kill her in this episode. And we need to say goodbye to her in this episode as hard as we did anybody else, or maybe even more so. And to me, like that was completely unnecessary. And this was an action finale. This was big drama. They had big epic action scenes. They could have done an hour of just battle, guns held to the head drama, and like the build up and all those build up scenes. Everything could take place in Alexandria modern time without the flashback stuff, and doing this kind of and then her sitting next to Maggie too with that goodbye scene. It was just too it was disingenuous.
Do you know what I felt? What felt weird to me is the fact that I cared more when Abraham died in episode one than I did when Sasha passed away. And what they were trying to do was build this whole thing with Sasha to make you have the same feeling of when he passed away. And when we lost those characters in the first episode, and it just never got to that climax because that Negan scene was such a 11 out of 10 that anything else in this season could not cap that episode one. So everything else fell flat. And her changing and going after him was just such a piss poor action because like, so she gets out of the coffin and jumps at him. I never felt he was in danger ever. Like I never thought like when she jumped on him, I'm like, well, he's going to get out of this. It's not that big of a deal. He's not going to get bit. It never drew me in.
I wasn't sure if Simon was going to survive.
Well,
but you I think to what you were saying about last episode is that I think he's become a bigger character, and that's why he survived. One of the things though, how did you guys think that when Daryl climbed up on top of that? I was waiting for just the very last scene to see a bullet go through and have him fall down. I'm like, they're gonna kill Daryl off right now. When he at the end, when everybody retreated out and he stands up on top, I was like, they're gonna kill him.
Now Scott Gimple has no more balls left to do movies like that. His stuff is the pull the carpet out stuff. It's these emotional heartstring tugs. I'm really not liking his show running right now. When it was Frank Darabont and when there's a whole other team of people involved, when it's right now, it's so predictable that like there's things I didn't believe in this episode. The things I didn't believe in this episode, there's a list. I didn't believe Daryl was going to kill Dwight once.
Nope, not even close. Not even at all. Not even once.
You're trying to fake me out with that? Didn't believe it. Another thing I didn't believe. I didn't believe Michonne fell off that roof and died. Not a second.
Nope. Not even a close. Yep. Nope. Didn't even think that at all.
I didn't believe that the Kingdom and Hilltop were not going to help. Always knew they were going to show up.
Yep. I was just waiting for the cavalry. It's like, when is the cavalry arriving?
Yeah. They were walking. Maggie was talking to them at the beginning. They're coming. So why these fake outs? There's more. The scavengers were going to be on Alexandria's side throughout the whole fight. I never believed they were going to be on their side the whole fight.
No.
Damien told me that earlier. He hinted at it in previous ones for me, but at the same time, it was in their actions. They basically say, like, we just take and they're creepy people. There's everything set up for them not to be on their.
But how fun was that scene where she tried to have sex? Yeah, she wanted to have sex with Rick.
That was pretty awesome.
Right, that was pretty awesome. Like that game, that was like, okay, so this is why Michonne gets pissed later on in the episode. You know what I mean? Like, she wanted to bang my boy. Like, what's up?
I lay with him after, right?
Yeah,
I lay with him after. Yeah. She doesn't even mind sloppy seconds. No. She's like, I'm okay with sloppy seconds. It's okay.
All right. So quickly, three more things that I did not believe was going to happen. I never believed Sasha was not going to die. They set it up right away with the emotional scenes and with the pill last episode. So don't give me this long drawn out stuff. She was going to die the whole time. I never believed Walker Sasha was going to kill Negan, like we just said earlier. And I never believed, this was long before, I never believed Sasha and Abraham felt that intensely that they did for each other that we saw in this episode, because their relationship was never this intense. This was a fake ending of a relationship that they did to tell it the way they wanted to, or to make some fans happy. But their relationship before Abraham died was never that was on the screen.
There are a few things that I have some questions, and maybe we can answer as a group. What do you think the terms the scavengers had with what terms were the deal with Negan? Because they're supposed to be getting something.
They said cases.
So are they getting 12 or 10? Are they getting 12 or 10? Yeah, 12 or 10. Are they getting 12 or 10 saviors, or are they getting 12 or 10 more of the scavengers back that he took?
Oh.
Because he said Negan does say people. So yes. it is people. I would. That's a good point.
I'm curious on whether they're trying – if she's doing this because she's saving her own tribe and she's getting 10 or 12 more people back, or if she feels like she needs to build an army and she's getting 10 or 12 saviors back.
They just take – so going from just the scavengers thing of we just take, I'm thinking they get 10 Alexandrians. Like they pick – like he's not – Negan's not giving up his people, but if she turns on the Alexandrians, she gets to pick 10 of them and take back – with her. And I think that was the deal they made, and that's, they will definitely probably expand on that in future episodes, but yeah,
I would assume so. Yeah.
Now
that's a good question.
Do you have any other questions with that, Chris? Or
I got a bunch.
Let's throw them out. Let's see what we can do.
All right, what is does Negan still trust Eugene?
Yes.
Yeah,
he asks him at the end, and he thinks about the, like, I know he knows that something's up, but he's like, I got bigger fish to fry right now, so I'm gonna let this one slide for now. But do you think, like, later on down the road, he's going to be like, I'm going to test you again because now I really don't trust you?
I think he's definitely going to do something. Like, I feel like he's going to bring – he's going to catch – what's going to happen is you're going to get an episode. He's going to catch an Alexandrian, and he's going to put a gun in Eugene's hand. He's going to be like, okay, or the bat, or he'll hand Lucille over. He'll be like, guess what? You're up to bat.
Yeah.
You picked the wrong time to leave me, Lucille.
Oh, no. It's not going to be just any Alexandrian.
It's gonna be Rick.
It's gonna be Rosita.
Oh, Rosita.
That is foretelling, and that actually that would make sense, and that would be, especially if he does do it, that would be a huge story arc change.
Yeah. No. And that's the season finale of the mid season finale next season. I think is Eugene having. Just because you brought it up now, it just makes too much sense.
That
Eugene
does make a lot of sense.
Eugene has to kill Rosita, and he does.
Yeah.
And that's fully is a savior. He's fully.
Another question. What happens to Oceanside? Because we promised them to have their weapons back. Now all the weapons are gone.
You can't take back what you can't find.
So do you think that they join up with Rick's crew? Or do you think that they are just completely taken off the episode and you never hear about them again?
I think that they're going to wind up filling in because a lot of side, like, characters that you see in the background, the filler characters, are dead now. They're going to need more filler characters for Alexandria. I bet you that they bring Oceanside to Alexandria. That way they have filler characters.
Yeah, but that's a riding logistics thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. This is just like they don't leave. Like the Oceanside people don't leave. They're scared of running into Negan's people again. So they would have to go get their guns. If Rick makes any assumption that they're not going to do that, then we just forget about them. Yeah.
Norman Reedus got a symbol at the end of this episode that some people got right away and some people didn't get right away. Yep. Is Dwight still trying to kill Negan?
Yes.
I feel like he has nothing else to live for any longer because his wife is gone. So now he's just angry. And when he wrote that, I didn't know. He didn't know that there were that the scavengers were going to pull that switch. Yeah. He had no clue.
That was the None. End. Because there's been a lot of debate on what he didn't know, but I think of the big reveals that happened to this fight, the scavengers turning is the one that really turned the fight. So that
because he knew everything else. He knew that they were coming. He knew where they were coming. He knew that the trees would stop them. He knew all of that stuff. And the part he didn't know was it because it caught us it caught me off guard. I knew it was coming, but I didn't know when it was coming. And the fact that she pulled the gun on him right away was like, all right. And then when the bomb didn't go off, I'm like, oh no.
Same here.
This is going bad real fast. Mm-hmm. So you could see that happening. Another question I have is, where's Gregory? I thought Gregory was going to see our boy with the mustache, and that's what he was gonna go do. Did he do that? Is he going to see somebody else? How is he trying to take power away from Maggie? Why did he leave?
So two thoughts on that. One, he never made it to Negan, and he's lost somewhere being held pinned down by walkers. Two, he made it to Negan, warned them of the stuff. Negan went to the scavengers, made the deal. They turned. That's what we got in this one. I think the second one's the more likely one. We just didn't get to see him do that because us seeing him do that makes the scavengers turn more surprising. So I think that's it.
I feel like a backstory on the scavengers for a full hour episode is almost necessary. If you're going to
kind of like they did with Morgan when they explained his backstory, that would actually be kind of that actually could be entertaining as long as they start off talking normal.
Well, the reason why I think it's so important is because it'll give us who the 10 to 12 are. So it serves that purpose. Mm-hmm. And then it also serves the purpose of finding out why the deal was made, you know, how he found out and then how the deal was made. So it kind of serves both purposes. And you can knock that out in a 1 hour episode.
Yeah. I like both those things. You have to start them talking up the wrong way. You got to get a good writer to be able to explain that properly. And I like Chris's tying up on the end. I like it.
And how did that tiger know how to chew people that were not part of their crew? How?
Emos. That's all I want to know. Emos.
I hate dropping I'm sorry for dropping the F-bomb, but like it's really just bananas. Like it's like the tiger jumps out. I'm like, where? Or, not. It's not a tiger. It's a what is a long, no, it's a tiger.
It's a tiger.
I'm like, where did it come from? One, and how did it know to kill the right people? It's almost like one of those. It's like having a video game character where you can like direct it. And you're like, all right, I want you to kill that person, and then that person, and then that person. And that's basically
sync
what he
shot.
Did. Sync shot.
Yeah,
and also, Ezekiel was like, he's terrible. So, like, I've never seen him really kill anybody ever. And all of a sudden, he's a quick shot with a rifle, and, like, he can just take people out. When did that occur?
Yeah, he's a zookeeper in real life. Drama.
Zookeeper.
Actor.
Zookeeper that's a quick shot. So, those are all the questions I had for The Walking Dead. There were just a couple of questions that were, like, just lingers out there with this season finale. If you can't tell, for me, this laid way flat to the point where I'm contemplating not going back to next season. I really am. Oh. Because I dragged through this last episode. I really did. It was not interesting at all. In fact, while I was watching this, I was thinking about watching 13 Reasons Why because I'd been in the middle of that. And I'm thinking, well, that's more interesting than this at this point. So it could have been that too. I didn't care for Sasha. I didn't care for the storyline. I didn't care for how it ended. There was no big, you know, I think as a Walking Dead fan, you're always expecting a hook or a cliffhanger. This didn't, apparently it was a cliffhanger, but it didn't feel like one. And so I just, we're seven seasons. We're heading into season eight. I don't know if we're hitting to the point where this is like, okay, enough is enough. I mean, cause a lot of shows that go this long kind of hit that spot where it's like, okay, we're starting to lose people. And they are. Walking Dead is losing people. They're losing people, the viewership.
Yeah, and they're losing cast, too. Sasha left to go to Star Trek, so they killed her off. Yeah.
Yep, for sure. And Norman Reedus has pretty much come out and said he's on his way. So I don't want to belabor the point with Walking Dead any longer, but it's kind of divisive, at least for me.
Yep. I want to hit one point on for me. Like, I kind of finally wrapped my head around why I'm losing interest in Walking Dead, really, because each half season, it just is a long setup for the next half season. And then the next half season is a long setup for the next half season. And it doesn't really do something those seasons besides really set up the next ones for the most part. And I think that's kind of why I'm losing interest. I still like it. It's still better than most other shows I can find on TV. So I'm probably still going to continue it. And there's one real reason I want to continue seeing it, because Negan started off with the eeny, meeny, miny, mo, catch a tiger by the toe. I want to see Shiva catch Negan by his toe, and he's crawling away, dragging him. And there's Shiva in the back, pulling him by his toe, and she eats him. I want to see that scene.
He was like, oh, shit, that's a tiger. that was awesome. That line was awesome. To your point, Cajun, the show, I like the characters. The problem is the side stories have become less and less interesting for me. So it's just like before I got to hear a backstory about each person. Now when I get the backstory, it's kind of like, oh, really? This could be like two episodes. Like you could wrap two of these characters into one episode. You don't have to draw out. Like when they went to Oceanside and they did the whole Oceanside episode, they really pushed the limits of an hour on that. That could have been 20 minutes. And so I feel like they feel the need to draw these things out because it's like, well, we have to hit a certain episode cap. And instead of having good storytelling, they just have storytelling. So I think we're moving on to Game On.
First up in Game On, listening through last week, I realized I promised 15 different Kurok locations. I got to 4. We got sidetracked, went on to Mass Effect, and never came back to the other 11. So I'm going to quickly go through all of the crazy different Kurok locations that are in Zelda because I started last week and I never finished it. number 5, yellow flowers. If you see a yellow flower in the distance or anywhere, and you go and you touch it, it will disappear and appear somewhere else. And if you find the locations 4 or 5 times, then boop, the last one's going to be a white flower. You get a Korok. This one I didn't know until I was researching it. Fruit trees. I finally did this after the last episode. If there's a couple of isolated fruit trees, however the fruit is on the tree, if there's 3 pieces of fruit on 1, 4 on another, and 5 on the last one, if you make all the trees with 3 in the exact same pattern, like cutting down the other, like knocking out the other pieces of fruit, then one will appear. And I never knew that until I was researching this. So, and I've seen tons of fruit trees sitting together like that, and I just get the fruit and cook it. So I never knew that. Under ice, you can melt ice. I see ice sitting anywhere, you can melt it. When it melts, one could pop up. A lily circle, if you're by a lake and there's a circle of lilies, just jump into it. One pops up. Moving magic, if you see magic dust floating in the distance in the grass and somewhere, go and examine that magic. One's going to pop out of there. One right at the beginning in Kokoriko Village is offerings. Whenever you see these little like statues with little offering plates in front of them, there's going to be an offering already in one of the plates at least. Match that offering into all the others. If it's apples, rusty shields, whatever, match all the offerings in all the plates. One pops up. Rock glyphs. It's a rock design that you need to alter and to make a match. And if you make it match up, one pops up. Orange pinwheel. If you see an orange pinwheel floating in the distance, you go and you touch it, and then it pops up a shooting gallery. Shoot all the stuff. One pops up. And then you get a small rock where one should not be. You're like, how? This one's great for geologists out there. How could a boulder fall here? If the answer is impossible, pull it up. There's going to be a core rock underneath there, guaranteed 100% of the time. And a rock circle. If there's a rock circle anywhere, throw a boulder into that. One pops up. And then the leaf stump tree. This one stumped me forever. I never knew what this was. There's a stump of a tree with a painted leaf on it. You step on it. A yellow circle appears, and you go and you pass through that yellow circle. One pops up, and that's it. That's your 15. I did it in a couple of minutes. We're caught up from last week. Now we can move on to the rest of Game On. And next up is Destiny: Old Raids Becoming New. Anybody stepped into the Vault of Glass this week?
I have.
Yeah. How far you got, man?
We got past Aetheon, or not Aetheon, but I'm sorry, the Templar, and then past the Gorgon maze. We didn't try to kill the Gorgons. We were just trying to rush through to get the checkpoint, but that's where we stopped.
Okay. So you got to the first part of Aethon. Yeah, I got to the last phase of the Templar fight. So as of this recording, it's only been out two nights, and I didn't get to play last night after a really, really long day, and another long one again today. So I only got to we got past Oracles. Yay!
So what are the changes?
One. Yeah.
What are the changes that makes this harder?
Challenge modes. So with the Templar, you have to make sure that the Templar does not teleport in order to pass the challenge mode. And for Atheon, you have every single person on the fire team has to kill a Oracle every time you go get teleported either into the future or into the past.
Yeah, so six people all have to go through the teleporter, and so you have to cycle people out to keep it open and kill an Oracle. So that one looks to be difficult. And one thing in the Oracle fight. Know how the oracles used to count up? You started out with a small number and you counted up to, I think you started with 3 and went to 7. This one counts down. You start from 7 and you go to 4. So it makes it a little easier. So as people are dying or the fight's getting tougher, the oracle count goes down. But it's still difficult because it's 390 light and the supplicants explode in your face on the regular. And yeah, it's still a crazy intensive fight, but it's just a reverse order, which I think in theory makes it easier. We kind of struggle bust for a bit on it, but it was good.
Yeah, I got the Templar checkpoint, and I bashed my head against the wall for a couple hours with Doozer and a couple Doozer from Nerdentials, and it was, I mean, it was interesting, but man, the changeups make me feel like where's my hidey hole? Like, there's no hidey hole anymore.
There's a wall.
There's a wall.
The hidey hole's gone.
I jumped into the wall and, like, got stuck. And I'm like, wait, what's going on? What's going on? And then I died. I'm like...
You died because stuff's shooting you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they got rid of the hidey spots. So
I did find a new hidey spot. Yeah. I did find a new hidey spot that works.
Yeah, there's a lot of corners in there you can hide, yeah. But at the same time, we were just, like, straight up murdering stuff during that fight because people were doing that the normal way anyway. Especially with tethers now and ranging supers. Oh, God. You throw a tether down there in the pit when he calls legions, and it's tether nades done. And, yeah. What really helped us out on the getting past the oracles was people all went to Gjallarhorn to take down Oracle. So each person would call out, like, Oracle far left. And then somebody say, got it. And that just means they're shooting a Gjallarhorn at it. So you didn't waste, we weren't wasting rockets, three people shooting, and one per each. Done. It was easy.
How's Sleeper Simulant working on this raid? Is it doing as good as, like, because I know originally what we had talked about, because I know Sleeper Simulant was a big use if you were to go back into the Vault of Glass, it just melted everything. How's that working right now in terms of the raid? Have you guys seen it used? Like, I tried to use it, and granted, I'm not the highest light level right now, but it didn't seem like it was going to do as much damage as the Gjallarhorn.
For Sleeper?
Yeah, the Sleeper.
No, Sleeper, you can one cycle Atheon with Sleeper if everybody's got Sleeper.
Yeah, oh, okay. Sleeper Simulant is fantastic for damage phase on Atheon. And on Templar, mainly because they're Templar stationary for the most part during that one, and Atheon doesn't move that much, and you're really close. Sleeper is great if you're getting crit hits. If you're not getting crits, then just get Gjallarhorn because it's useless. Useless, but
Black Spindle would be better, honestly.
So yeah, Sleeper is still absolutely fantastic, but you need to be getting crits with it.
Good to know. I'll try to make sure I get the crit hits next time.
Yeah, and if you're struggling with by not getting crit hits, do what I do, Gjallarhorn, because sometimes I'm super excited. I might not get it. I don't want to waste a shot. I know I'll get it with the G horns. Explode things up. Yeah, actually, somebody asked that question today. Like, somebody asked this in Slack today in Uprising. What's the theory question was this, and I'll pose it to you guys real quick. If they go with this in lore, that your vault is completely destroyed. You can't take any of your weapons from your vault with you, but you get to keep what is actually on your guardian when they attack. What weapon will be on your guardian that you get to take with you into Destiny 2? Mine's Gjallarhorn.
Raise letter.
Ooh, yeah.
Thorn.
Thorn.
I love Thorn. I love Lamp.
I think Chris gets the crickets button for this one.
Yeah, Cricket's written for this one because, like, I'm already into Destiny 2. Like, I'm past Destiny 1.
He's having drinks in the bar with Cade.
No, Damien's talking about 3D8. I'm like, dude, I've been 3D8 for years. Like, I'm just ready. I'm ready to go.
Listen. Yeah. Some of us.
I'm ready to go.
Some of us have been a little bit, you know, Destiny's. Some of us have been with the side with some of the side chicks for a while. We're just now coming back into bed with Destiny. So
yep, the Backlog Chronicles.
Yeah, you've been with the Schlong Elongator, right? Is that?
Yep. you mod your schlong.
Can you mod the G-string? Can you make it like a different color?
You can actually do a lot of different mods you can download for that thing. But
so the left can be longer than the right. Oh, is that how it works?
Oh, like truck nuts.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Since you're talking about it, I was using it more as we're talking about Conan Exiles and how modding has created a different experience than first intended. It's, you know, I've just been started getting into PC games again recently, and the early access games that are on PC that allow mods, you can really, if you get into a good community, you can do a lot. You can do a lot with it. And actually, I just got into a community for streamers. Well, it's mostly for streamers, and then you actually RP and act out your characters, and they actually have, but what's cool about this is some of the people have actually utilized Kinect sensors, you know, the ones that aren't being used anymore, but they use them, and they've created animation overriders so that they can actually have it, things that weren't in the game yet. You can actually sit down and just a little, like, you know, things that work out for, say, you're watching a stream and he's acting his character out and he's going to a feast. Instead of seeing a bunch of people kneeling down, they're actually sitting down and actually drinking grog or whatever, mead, but it's just been a really cool experience to be able to take yourself out of the aspect of just playing a game and helping create a story, because they're doing the server that I'm talking about, they're actually doing a season 2. I'm coming in for that, and it's a faction storyline, and I'm actually helping write some of the story, and so it's cool going into things like that where you can write your character story and it gets brought in with your faction leader who's a streamer. And so when you're playing with them, you're acting out this character because everything's voice acted. So you have to act out in character. A lot of people using voice changers and things like that for different roles. And it's entertaining to watch. And makes it basically it. Yeah, it's Conan right now, but you can do this in many of the other games and titles that are coming out that are on PC that allow modding. And it's turning my. I've always been kind of. I go and play the vanilla game, or I get the DLC that the company puts out. This is changing my tune to where I'm starting to really enjoy mods, aside from the ones that you guys are talking about. I won't touch those.
I got one word for you.
Sure, you won't.
Nerd. I'm just messing. Do you think, seriously, on a serious note, we were talking about the ability to upgrade on PC quickly, Xbox Scorpio, right?
Yeah.
And playing Conan on that and being able to mod a much faster than you could on general console. Do you feel like that's going to be a thing for this game?
Considering the fact that mods are coming to Arc now pretty soon, when Arc officially launches, whenever that happens, it's kind of in DayZ mode right now, but when it does officially launch, they're going to have mod support on Xbox. That should be being said at probably E3, but Conan will probably have it as well, because they've been already talking about it.
I guess that's so, Damien, it, right?
Damien got a chance to do a review of a old classic in a new form.
Yeah, so we all have, like, a lot of us have played Banjo-Kazooie in the past, one of Rare's original titles on the Nintendo 64.
N64, yes!
And it was amazing. It was, I mean, what we got to play, Brandon's also played it too. And
I have. It's awesome.
I mean, if you take, you take Mario, Sonic, Banjo, and you kind of mix it in with a little bit of even Conker humor, you get Yooka-Laylee. Yooka is the chameleon, and Laylee is this bat, which plays a part of basically she's kind of like a more family-friendly Deadpool, because she breaks the fourth wall all the dang time. You got the characters that you interact with in this game are amazing. I wrote an article over on Rectify Gaming. It's out now. Be streaming the game. Should be streaming when this episode goes live on Monday. It comes out on the 11th, but Monday is when the NDA lifts, so we'll be able to have all the information on this. You can tweet out to me, and I'll talk even more about it. But a character that you interact with, and I thought this character was so cool. I want an action figure of this character. You go up. The character that sells your moves in this game is a snake, but the snake it loops down and has like a base, then comes back up through a pair of pants. So it took me a second to catch the joke. And I'm like,
there's a snake in my pants, not in my boots.
Well,
even better.
His name's Trouser.
He's a Trouser snake.
Trouser snake. Nice.
Brandon, what was some of your favorite things from Yooka-Laylee?
I just love the gameplay, the movement of it, and everything else. It just reminded me of the old school games, and I just loved it.
Thing about this game is that some people have stated, you know, it wasn't a 10 out of 10 for them or anything because of there wasn't enough worlds. They're saying that there was, you know, there's only 5 worlds. Well, there's 5 worlds, but these worlds can be expanded upon, like doubled in size, which essentially gives you 10 worlds. And there's not say and there is,
what do you mean could be double in size? Like you build these worlds?
No, what it is there's things you have to collect in each of the levels, and then after you collect so many of the pages is what they are, then you can go exit out of that world back into the main world and enlarge the quote-unquote book, which is the world.
Okay.
When you do that, it adds more areas that you can go to, more things to find, more things to do.
Oh, okay. So it's sort of procedurally generated, or it's previously generated?
Previously generated. You're just unlocking
it. Previously generated.
Yeah.
Now, you have moves literally like Sonic. You have a move where you're rolling fast uphill. It's not super fast, but it's still the Sonic motion. You can glide. You have Yoshi-like movements or Kirby where Yooka can take in items, and then he'll get an element from it. Like if he eats like a red, like a fire berry, he can breathe fire. Ice ones, he can shoot ice balls out. If he takes in like something that glows, and you're in a dark area and you can't see, all of a sudden his whole body is glowing and illuminates the area. It's just an N64 feel. Like it feels like Banjo-Kazooie. It feels like Super Mario 64. And it hits just awesome in the nostalgia factor. Member berries. One of the things that I actually critiqued it on was the controls on Xbox felt a little stiff with the camera controls, but they actually just put a patch out for that, so it's fixed. Before launch came out, they're like, "Oh, we got to fix this." There is one thing that hasn't been patched yet. Now, when you first hear it, you're like, "Oh, this is just like the Nintendo 64. I love this." But it's you hear this sound anytime they start talking, and it doesn't stop. And so you'll find yourself sometimes clicking the button to eliminate the text and just get back to gameplay. And by doing so, you miss out on a lot of really well-written jokes with very spot-on British humor.
Oh, okay. Nice. So how would you compare this to... Speaking of games that are kind of that style to it, how would you compare this, or did you play the Death Spank trilogy of games?
I did not play those.
Okay, so we can talk about those at a later date, but that sounds similar to those in terms of the humor and gameplay from a few years back.
The review on these pieces has gone the full spectrum. We have fives all the way up to, I think the cap is like around 8.5 on this. What are some of the things where you say to yourself, okay, I can see where it got the reviews that it got on the low end of the spectrum? Because I understand that yours is on the higher end of the spectrum. What are some of the negatives?
The negatives are, when a lot of us were reviewing this title, again, it was the control of the camera. you go into these different, some of the, one of the realms you go into, it's more focused on jumping and doing more platforming than it is on exploration necessarily and having feeling lived in. There's a world that you go into that's like a casino. And that's when a lot of people where they're like, they kind of dropped it. They're like, oh, it just, there's things to do just to do. One thing that was, but the thing about that is yeah, that world is a platformer world. There was maps in Sonic that I'd get to a level and it was like, oh, this is just a bunch of water and I have to be able to get through the water and not drown. It's something like that. And I can see that, you know, yeah, when I played it, it wasn't as fun for me. But it was still fun, but it wasn't the same that, say, someone else that, like, I think that the reviewers should come back and check it out now it's patched. The sound, though, when characters are talking, will start to grate on you. Like, if it doesn't, you must be deaf. That is one that seriously, like, if I didn't think that they would have patched it, that it would have been a seriously drawback for me. But they have announced, they have said that they are going to address that in an upcoming patch, which is spot on. The other thing is you got to look at these games. You can't grade them on just as a title as on themselves. You got to put them up against things and see, you know, okay, Banjo-Kazooie was, you know, what grades did it get? What did that? It's updated graphics, old style gameplay that we have not seen in a long time. A lot of people thought that the platformer was dead. This is showing that there's still a lot of life in it. You got to give your grade on the fact that the price point is $39.99. Okay, that's $40. That's, you know, that you can play with your family. There's a multiplayer that does feel kind of tacked on, but it's just little kind of fun party games.
I know the biggest argument for this Playtonics game is the fact that the levels were not enough. That in a Mario game you can have up to 12 levels or 12 worlds to explore, and this had what I believe
five.
Six.
It's five, but if you count the hub world, then there's six.
Then there's six, and I know IGN's Marty Sliva's biggest complaint was one of the five was a terrible, the casino world was horrid. So you're down to four. So and you can use in-game currency to expand these and almost double the length of those, but still it felt like all it was doing was recompensating some of the pieces and just making it a bigger world. Is that
I
haven't played it, so I'm just asking. Yeah,
and I can get that, Brandon.
One of the reasons I can see it having the lower scores for some people is the game is kind of childish. I honestly feel it's, even though it's got a lot of innuendos and things like that for the adult gamer, it's geared more to a younger audience. And so most of the older, you know, our age type reviewers would probably like, okay, this is kind of just childish and stupid and things like that. So that may be some of the reason why some of the reviewers gave it a lower score. I'd buy it if it went on sale, but I wouldn't pay for the 40 for it. Although I do like the game and it was fun, I would wait for it to go on sale personally because I don't know when I'd play it.
If this was a pickup and travel game, if this was a Switch,
game. If it's a Switch game, perfect.
Does it change the it's like, oh man, Switch, dude, I can play this on a train, play it on a plane.
That would be perfect.
This is a Switch title all the way. Like it's nice to have it access to something like this on a console. But yeah, this on Switch. Yeah, that when it comes to Switch, it's a day one purchase. I would totally recommend it.
So it's time to move on to the hype train. So let's start off the hype train with something that's been on Xbox gamers' minds. What's in the box?
Power is in the box. The specs, I looked at the specs. The thing is powerful. We can start spouting off numbers, but there's a million articles out there. This is an audio podcast. It's great. We'll go with that. But the thing about it for me is a lot of the dialogue around it and its power is better loading times in games. But it was a lot on the graphics side. And for me, not a 4K TV owner, and I sit very far away from my screen, so I already know the reason I don't own one is because I'm never going to sit close enough to any size 4K screen to get the benefit of it. That, how do I justify that? Because for me, I don't get the GPU benefits. I get just the load time benefits. I get the game processing benefits.
You can get the frame processing, though. You can get that.
The benefits for this to me are people who hear the word 1070 and 1080 and can't afford to own a PC that runs that. So the Xbox will do that because it's comparable to a 1070 or 1080 as far as your GPU. It's a snappier processor. It doubles the rate as far as the DDR, I think, as far as the...
It's going from 8 gigs DDR3 mm-hmm. on the Xbox One to 12 gigs DDR5.
Now, it's not going to run...
Huge improvement.
It's not running a solid state, right? It's actually running a 1 terabyte hard drive. So that's gonna that was a little bit of a bummer. Like, that's the one bummer I actually heard from anybody who talked about it, was they thought that it was gonna be a solid state, but it's not. No big deal.
That would bump the price up so much for any solid state that's a substantial amount of storage, that it would just make it go skyrocket.
For all of you non-cigarette smokers and those who vape, there's a vaping system in this bad boy that runs the cooling system that causes this thing to run apparently uber quiet, and it has the ability to let it be small as opposed to being one of those large boxes. I don't know if you own the PS4 Pro like I do. The thing is like double the size of the PS Slim, so like it's pretty gnarly.
The power box is internal, which is great too, like the Xbox One S.
That's really, really cool. The biggest complaint are, where are the games? Well,
E3.
The games aren't even E3. The games are Gears, which they told you it was going to be. Forza, which they told you it was going to be. ReCore, which they told you it was going to be.
Sea of Thieves.
They're going to retread a lot early. A lot of the games are going to be retreads. They're going to be 4K up bumps from stuff that was on the Xbox One. If you want to know where all of your Scorpio games are, they're Xbox One games. That's where they are. Ask the PS4. That's what they did. The PS4 Pro just upgraded a lot of their games and moved them to 4K. Initially, that's what the games are going to be. Because the reason why I tell you this is because if you looked at the early outlook, and Phil Spencer was on Unlocked, and he said, okay, well, you're going to get a little bit more information about the Scorpio, right? So instead, we all thought that it was going to be, they're going to have this thing at Xbox campus, and they're going to show us and tell us about it, and they're going to show us and tell us the price, and then they're going to show the games at E3. My thinking is this Eurogamer is their version of telling us about it? We're only going to see this thing at E3, and the reason why is because Xbox is not confident about the games. They're confident about the piece. They're not confident about the games. So if they held this press conference and talked about the box at E3, and they're only talking about the games, they don't feel comfortable and feel like their lineup is expansive enough to talk about it in that manner. So they're going to use the E3 press conference to talk half about the box and then the rest about the games. And they feel like that can fill out the rest of their E3 press conference. I think that's the reason why what you see on the internals is all you're going to get until E3.
Yeah.
If you think about it, Crackdown, Sea of Thieves, what else? I mean, what else?
We are getting the games that are coming out. Anybody who has it, they're going to have a better graphic wise. They're is going to be going towards Xbox with Scorpio, the new Battlefield, what's funny is that because Sony may have exclusivity on timed exclusives with some of these titles like Red Dead Redemption, Battlefield. Star Wars Battlefront 2. But what Xbox gets is they're going to have the exclusive native 4K. And now I get, if you don't have 4K, that's one thing, but the Scorpio still will run these games better and they will look prettier even on a 1080p than what they would on a regular Xbox One S.
Yeah, there's always the better power and be able to tell that difference. And if they hit that price point right where people are going to be able to do that and enjoy the faster load times, the better power, and enjoy the better graphics, boom, they're going to be in a nice market and be existing selling consoles waiting for their one exclusive game, the one game that somebody makes for Scorpio, who comes out and says, I couldn't make this for the other systems. This is the only thing that can run my game. And they just got to sit there and wait for that. Or fund it themselves. But that's going to be the differentiator. That has to come out before PlayStation comes out with their next one.
You threw out like three things. One, Scorpio stated that they're not going to have exclusive games that aren't Xbox One. So the games have to play on Xbox One.
It's back.
Two, you hit on the price point. I don't give a shit what's in this system. If that price point is $4.99, the buyer's market is going to say no thank you. Because
they'll buy it.
The PS4 Pro.
$4.99, I think, is a great price point for this thing. Yeah.
You can get the PS4 Pro to run almost identical to this thing for close to half the cost by the time Black Friday hits.
It's 25% to 30% better, more power. Just looking at the numbers, it's 25% to 30% across
the board. You're looking at the numbers, but if you're looking at 4K, it's not going to matter. It's going to be 4K across PS4 Pro and across Scorpio. They're going
upscaled
upscaled
and native is two different things.
I understand it's two different things, but to the native eye, is it going to be looked that different? Not that much on a 4K screen. If I'm standing at a 32-inch screen that's less than 5 feet away from me, they're going to look the same.
$4.99 is a great price for this thing, even though the PS4 Pro is different. I think the delta is going to be enough to justify, because people spend $1,000 more for a better PC to get that much more processing power, when the naked eye for them is not going to tell a difference, just because they know they have that better processing power. Not for now, not for the games they have now, for what they're going to be playing in the future. The games that are going to struggle on PS4, PS4 Pro, and Xbox One, they want that system that game is going to hum on. That's why they spend the extra money now for the new computer. That's why they would spend it for the Scorpio, is for that.
But $500 is, you're talking about the elite of the elite that's going to pay for this. If you're talking about the average consumer that's going to come across, they're going to look at the word $500 and then they're going to look at $250 and they're going to, oh, what's the difference? They play the same games. You have the same games.
When Xbox One came out, it was $500.
Xbox was $500 at launch.
Yeah. And I had
launch. And
so what are you going to get? What are you going to be able to get an S at on Black Friday?
Xbox One S, you'll probably be able to get it for $200.
$200. Okay. And so the average consumer who has a 1080p monitor or 1080 screen versus a 4K screen, and the only difference between the two is the fact that you're going to get 4K versus 1080, is going to go with something that's $200 versus something that's
$500. Yeah, but listen, that's sales for Xbox.
No, I understand that. And the fact that they premium priced the Scorpio almost forces it produces consumers for the lower price point. It's like, okay, well, you want our price point at $500, but because we have such a premium product, obviously we have a premium service, so let's go to the lower price point, and it raises the value of the Xbox One S. But at $200, people are going to go to that. And Phil Spencer said this on Unlocked. We realize our bread and butter is the Xbox One S. The premium service, or the premium console, is for the Scorpio. And so I understand that that's going to be the case, but man, I still feel like $500 is a lot. I feel like I will get it, but that's because I always go after whatever's next. But I feel for the average consumer in November, which this is probably the rumor is November, the rumor is $4.99, and right before Black Friday, Christmas time, $500, lots of money. Man, you better have your savings, Pence. You know, you want to have it saved up.
This will be a parent-only console. I am not upgrading the others.
Exactly, but this is for the people who buy a 4K. Because right now, if somebody has a 4K TV as every TV in their house, they're gonna and they play games, they're gonna be able to buy the system because they can afford a crazy amount of money on all 4K systems. If somebody is always adopting the new tech and dropping money left and right on it, this is the system for them. And that's their market right now. That's their market is that, and those consumers are the people who adopt stuff first. And I think, Chris, you're speaking for yourself, but you're also speaking for a lot of people who are like yourself, who are going to get this no matter what. And I think there are a lot of people who are going to get it no matter what, who are into games, who want the biggest and best system, and for many other reasons besides it. And you're right, the average consumer, they're just going to be fine going with the Xbox One S and other systems and paying less money. but there is a market for this, and it is out there, and it is I think it's going to sell at 500 very well. But if they come in at $600-$700, yeah, that's when you're going outside of what people are expecting at this point in time, and the valuation is not double. I mean, you're talking 20% to 30% more of the power, so you expect it to be maybe 30% more than other systems, not 50-100% more.
And I respect Digital Foundry. I mean, there's a reason why Xbox let them come to campus, because they're the elite of the elite of the gobbledygook when it comes to what is in the system and how does it work and they're the people you go to when you're looking at 4K versus 1080 and what's the difference on this system and that system. So knowing that they were only going to spit what's in the box and not the price point and not what the box looks like and what the games play like, I got that was going to be the case. And we realized that in the future, we're going to be able to see these things. What's going to sell the system is price point and story. What games do you have and how much are you selling to that? And that'll be what determines this game. So the Digital Foundry stuff and saying it's going to play at 60 frames, at 4K and it's going to be no issue, that's all fine and well that you can say that in theory. I want to see that in action. I want to see it in a game. I want to be able to see more than one game that's able to do that, not somebody that's maximizing that's had 6 months to try to play with this thing. A real, developer that has to make a game. And let's see Destiny play this at 4K at 60 frames. Let's see Bungie do that. Let's see we watch any type of Call of Duty game. Let's play that at 60 at 4K. If you get a few games under your belt and that plays at that rate, now you have me. But the fact that, in air quotes, it's supposed to play at that, so is my 1070 and my 1080, but it doesn't play at 4K with 60, and I have to monkey with it in order to get it.
The thing is, what this is basically doing is this is putting a console in consumers' hands that will be able to handle games like PC. This is putting into the PC market of how games look, because I might be playing World of Warcraft and everything looks amazing, colorful, bright, and everything, and then Joe Schmo might be playing on a lower end PC and he's still playing, but everything's kind of more flat, not as bright, not as vibrant. It can take, PCs can take, are all across the spectrum. One person could have a PC that makes a game look like completely next gen, whereas you could come in and be playing a game on a PC that still looks good, but it's just not quite there. And that's what's going to happen is that the games that patch for this, it's going to basically be where on a PC you're able to take in and you have all these sliders you can move around. The Scorpio, you're not going to be able to move the sliders around because the developer is going to be like, this is what is the optimal with this parameters that we have for this machine. But it's going to be that difference when you see Xbox One or Xbox One S or Scorpio. You're going to see the differences between each of them. It's not, it'll be enough that's what you're doing, is you're basically buying yourself a gaming PC with a console peripheral.
The other thing that's nice is for Xbox to get this message out early, they can cut the bullshit. So when you get to E3, they can just talk about the games. I don't have to tell you about the specs. You already know what they are. I'll show you the box. I'll tell you the price point. Here are the games. And off we go. So when they say at E3, it's games, 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 it really is. Because for 5 minutes of this, 10 minutes of this, we're going to tell you about the box. And everything else is all about games. And I know that Fouts, yeah, well, Fouts is shooting off some stuff about the rendering and the 1080. I know it upscales. I know it upscales to 1080 to 4K. So it does a lot of other fun things. We'll know more.
It's actually downsampling to 1080p.
1080p.
Not upscaling.
Yeah, so we'll know more about
PlayStation's that.
We'll know more soon. Like, honestly, in the next 2 to 3 months, I think this is all we're going to get from Xbox. They gave you what the specs are. We'll get to see it in action at E3. I don't feel like there's going to be another drop on this at any time soon. I think this is what they were planning on showing, and that's the end of it. And we'll see in a few months.
Damien, you're excited about a movie?
Yeah.
What?
Damien's nodding his head. Damien, are you excited about a movie? The next one in the show notes? Yes, yes, I am.
Not so excited anymore. No, I am not excited. What are you talking about?
Should I talk about this movie I'm excited about? I don't know. Should I?
Is there a sword in, sword in the stone? I don't know.
Uh-huh. No, King Arthur Legend of the Sword dropped another trailer out. And, you know, we've talked about this a few different times about that it's very Guy Ritchie, which it is. It's very rock and roller, but... Man, it's great though. It's good. It looks fun.
It looks fun.
And that's what I like about it is that it's a sword and sorcery film that just looks like it's going to be a fun ride. And you know, when I'm watching it, and I just saw the preview when I went to see Ghost in the Shell with my, you know, my son, he saw it, he goes, "That looks fantastic." And his mouth's hanging open and he's like, "How cool would it be if there really was magic?" And it brought up a bunch, you know, he's just talking about all these little what if stuff, but he goes, because I tried to have him watch a couple movies in the past that were 80s sword and sorcery films, and he's like, I can't get into it, but this one he's all about, and it looks like it's going to be hit on the same level, I would say, as like a Lord of the Rings film. Cajun?
What could hurt this movie is could hurt other shows is that if it's just fun, the critics who get the first crack at the ratings are going to pan the crap out of it, and that's going to hurt its box office. Because Guy Ritchie did Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. He did Snatch. Those are great, gritty, crime British movies. Then he did Robert Downey Jr.'s Sherlock movies, and those are meh for me. Sherlock is a certain character, and he made this super fighting Sherlock movies, but all his stuff has this really gritty British feel that it's very heavy dialogue driven. And this looks like it has a lot of action, but there was one of the trailers that came out that was very dialogue heavy trailer. And I'm wondering if they're just showing all the action and you're going to get a very Guy Ritchie dialogue gritty movie where it's just going to be filming the slums of England, that and moving from pub to pub and bar to bar, building King Arthur up, and then with not a lot of action scenes. And I think that could really hurt this movie if it goes that route. But at the same time, what I saw in this trailer and the other action trailer looks like a fun movie. So that looks fun, especially with the big beast. I like that. May 12th, this comes out.
So the next movie up is involving Tom Cruise, which... As soon as I heard Tom Cruise, it was like, well,
yes, Tom.
This
Cruise.
Isn't this isn't 20 years ago. Yeah. So
it's Tom Cruise in The Mummy, but in this last trailer, we get to find out as a mummy, because it actually shows him revealing as a mummy in this last trailer. So that was an interesting twist.
I just can't get into this. Like, I literally can't. Like, I'm wanting to. I know, Damien. Like, Damien, you're like I can see steam coming out of your ears. But I mean, it looks good. If you substituted any other lead in this, I might be interested. But I actually have to watch Tom Cruise in a movie.
I'm done. This is okay. First off, this is now being used as the jump off spot for the Universal Monsters universe.
Yeah.
Which is going to include Tom Cruise.
But it also still includes Dracula from Dracula Untold. And that's
minor. The big one is you're going to have Russell Crowe as Dr. Jekyll.
And I told you guys, yeah, and also Javier Bardem as Frankenstein.
Yeah. So that those Wolfman are, has that, not been announced yet. Big universe. It's going to be very interesting. And I disagree with one thing Chris said about Tom Cruise and stuff, because the Mission Impossible movies has been, what, 5? They've gotten better as they've gone.
They have.
The last two are fantastic movies. Just great in plot and action all the way through. And he's great in them too. And he does a lot of the stunts in there too. Those are hands down great movies. And you don't even need to watch the other Mission Impossible movies to enjoy them. They can sit as standalone movies. They're both great. So I like him as an action scene. And even some of these scenes reminisce that to it. And even... oh God! I blanked on this last time we talked about it. The movie, the time loop movie he just did.
Oh, you're talking about, yeah, that one was phenomenal. You're talking about Live, Die, Repeat, but it's not Live, Die, Repeat. It is,
yeah. We'll think about it later because I completely forgot about it last time we talked about this movie. And I loved it. I love that movie too.
And that one's getting a sequel. That one's getting a sequel too.
It needs it. Yeah, that one needs it as well. But yeah, no, those great stuff. Go.
Okay. Another character. You know that Johnny Depp's joining this Universal Monster Group, right?
That's right. Is he the one that's playing Wolfman?
No, he's playing
the Invisible right. He's Man. Playing the Invisible Man. And then I forget who's playing. And
that's
I forget.
True. We laughed about that last time.
Yeah. I forgot. I'm trying to remember who's playing. There's another well-known actor, but he's going to be covered in makeup because he's playing Creature from the Black Lagoon. And I can't remember who's playing that. I'll have to look it up.
Let's hope they can get to that point.
Universal's all in. Universal's all in with that. Yes, Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I'm okay with the lead. I disagree on the lead scenario. The plot of this one is from the trailer, I don't know how great it's going to be, but it does look like it's a very world-building movie. That when you see Russell Crowe as Dr. Jekyll, and this is their world-building starter. This is their Iron Man 1 of their universe, because I think from initial reports, they're not going to be using hardly anything of the Dracula Untold stuff in this one. This is the main starter. They're going to ignore it because of how bad that one did critically. So they're
So all their lead characters are over the age of 50.
Yeah, yeah, it's acting driven stuff with Tom Cruise being your roided up, unnaturally active 50-plus-year-old action star. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not throwing salt on it. I'm just thinking in my head like every character like that you've rattled off is over the age of 50. So
yeah, doesn't leave a lot of room for different. Action. Yeah.
No, it doesn't. So
stunt doubles. Lots of stunt doubles.
There you go.
Or just get Stallone in it. Just get Stallone in it.
We've been talking Marvel for a while on Netflix, and finally we got a 20-second little teaser trailer.
Yeah, if you can call it
of
that.
Of the Defenders. Yeah. It was so fast that I was like, oh shit, oh wait, are they, oh, it's over. Yeah. Like that was literally how fast the trailer
click again,
was.
Click again. It's like, we filmed the scene. Click again. Show them the scene we filmed.
We all happened to get in the elevator at the same time.
Yeah,
it really was. Even like the Daredevil thing with the thing of the bandana over his face was like really kind of cool. But the scene had, you know, Iron Fist, Jessica Jones. It had Luke Cage, and it had Daredevil all in the elevator going up, and then you see Jessica Jones just like literally punch the camera that's in the elevator, and that was it.
A lot of people are speculating that the timestamp that's on that security camera is actually the release date for the Netflix series of August 18th.
Oh, nice.
That's a meta. That's meta.
And
that's
was
awesome.
Their sneaky way of telling everybody without directly telling everybody when we should be expecting the Defenders on Netflix.
Nice.
So if that is correct and a lot of people's theories are correct, then August 18th of this year we shall have the Defenders. Yeah,
that would be awesome. But
one thing we did see in this scene, although it was short, is that they just came from somewhere. Something happened intense. They were breathing heavily. People were taking note of themselves. They didn't just walk out of a lunch. That something just happened. And so that's all we get, which we know stuff's going to happen. But the one thing I know Chris said about the bandana on Daredevil, so that means he's not wearing his suit, but he's still protecting his identity. Nobody else is protecting their identity. But he's wearing the exact same style of head bandana that Iron Fist wears in all the comic books.
Yes.
I was like,
I noticed that. It even looked vaguely the same color.
Yeah. And then I'm looking like, okay, is that Iron Fist? Because originally when I saw it, I looked, double took, like, oh, Iron Fist is wearing his bandana. No, that's Daredevil. Iron Fist is just sitting there as Danny Rand in his curly hair. Why is he not wearing his bandana? And why is Daredevil not in his suit? Because Luke Cage and Jessica Jones aren't protecting their identity at all. So,
yeah, they don't care.
Yeah. That just brought up more questions for me. And I can't interpolate any more than that with a 20-second clip, but that was the thing that really jumped out to me. That was it.
All right. So Call of Duty is heading into a movie universe. For a movie that hasn't even come out yet, why do we have a universe?
The first thing they mention is Black Ops, which though the story for Black Ops, starting with World at War, and then going and bringing some of those characters into the Black Ops 1 and then 2 game, well, it worked, and it was, you know, a fun playthrough, but I don't... They're talking about making these movies all connect in the storyline, going from World War, having, you know, they would start in the modern times and go with that, and that they, but they would connect a TV series. They want to even go into TV with this and have a world, have characters that will connect up to the storyline, start in World War II on the TV. Like, it's like they're trying to go full Marvel on this. And yeah, Activision has the money to do this, but really? Like, it, you haven't milked this out so much. It's like, what's next? Guitar Hero, the movie? I mean, I guess you could...
The risk is so heavy on this, though. If you're going to go simultaneously with TV series and a movie franchise that might require pre-filming of future stuff, if you're trying to go deep with it like that, like, baby steps here, Activision. Like, these guys aren't known for taking financial risk. At least not at what seems to be this level outside of their realm and with this kind of scope. It's like some executive had a very good presentation and got excited.
Now they have producers that, you know, that have worked, they have film experience. They've worked on Cher has what she's let's see here. One of the co-presidents, Stacey Cher, she's worked on multiple Tarantino films. As well as she was a key exec at Disney during the Marvel and Lucasfilm acquisitions. But that doesn't mean, acquisitions does not mean that you helped create those cinematic universes. And so that's why it's like, one of my favorite storylines is Modern Warfare. The game was amazing and the storyline was amazing, but it's like, we played it, we've seen it. How are you going to make it different for us to experience it and then turn it into a universe? It's like,
The only reason you release that you have these people that work for your company that have film experience, even though it's weak as hell, is because you don't want people hedging their stocks when they hear this news. And if you're that scared, you probably shouldn't be doing it. And this just brings up more questions in terms of the quality of this decision. So,
When Marvel came up with the Iron Man series, all their intention was to have Iron Man. When the season or when the movie stopped filming, at that point they thought to themselves, wow, we could extend this. So they thought so highly of the series that they had what has never been done before prior to Iron Man, the extended cut, which had the after credits scene, which now everybody looks forward to. It didn't happen until the original Iron Man. And so that led to the Avengers. And it started the Marvel Universe. It started the MCU. So to say that you have an MCU prior to even the first film coming out is a little ballsy. You're assuming that the movie that you have once created is going to be well-received enough that it's going to deserve having a universe. This is something they should have held on to. They should have waited a little bit longer, and they should have let this thing cook and had the movie or at least a script ready and then started production and go, okay, I think that we have something here prior to saying that this was coming out, because I think they're overstepping.
This is another thing that instantly red flag is that they're saying that the first installment in the series could be ready as early as 2018.
There's no way.
That's saying no director. Even post special effects take usually longer than that. So it's just like, unless you're going to have, I mean, it's just nope.
Big bag of nopes. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, we're going to move on to a couple of new films, bringing up some of the past, right? So we have Dune film that's going to be coming out.
Yeah, and it's going to be written by Forrest Gump scribe Eric Roth. It's a total reboot, but it's that basically all they know right now is that it's being written by a well-known scribe, Oscar winning, actually, and then it's they're looking at, like, I think a 2020 release is what I was looking at, Cajun.
Yeah, but Danny Villeneuve is going to be directing it, so this, I mean, that dude has all the cred in terms of stuff. He did Sicario, which was great. He did Arrival, which I will watch by the end of this month. I need to watch
it. Arrival's a good movie. I haven't seen Arrival. No, Arrival's a good movie. Yeah.
And then he also did the up-and-coming Blade Runner 2049. And he's the one that's going to be, he signed on and directing Dune. And that's how you get good writers on it, when you put a director like that. And he's been wanting to do Dune for a long time. He said he's liked that storyline. I've liked that storyline. I even liked the original movie when I was younger. I need to rewatch it because it probably doesn't hold up, but I remember watching it younger and just enjoying it.
Patrick Stewart with hair.
And we know, we right? And we know Dune wasn't a critical success. It's become a success afterwards because it's been a cult hit.
Right.
And so you get enough of a groundswell on something, and then people are like, well, man, if we came out with a movie with this, enough people might watch it. So a couple of head nods, you throw out a few things on Twitter, you throw out a few, you know, AR things, and all of a sudden everybody's into it, and it's like, oh yeah, now we have a movie coming out. So Dune really needs to hit, and so they have to be careful on how they promote the movie and how they promote this reboot, because this is a one and done. If they make it, they're great, and if they don't make it, this is done. So they have to hit on this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it needs to sell to people beyond who have seen the previous ones.
Sure.
Because it is a large scope movie. If he goes big scope, which he's most likely going to do, considering who they're getting and the funding, I don't know what the number is, but it's probably going to be large. And he does go big scope, you need to make the money back, and you need to get people in those seats who have not seen the original or the TV series.
So speaking about bringing out movies that are from the past, Conjuring is also getting a cinematic universe treatment too. So what does that say for the horror genre in general, having these movies now come back up again?
Well, it's actually something that's never happened for horror films. I mean, other than like, if you're talking about the ones that are the quick, you know, low budget, but they make a lot of money because people just want basically gore porn. You got those type of films that are coming out. But the difference with The Conjuring is The Conjuring's all based on the lore and the stories behind the Warrens, which if you ever read any of the, if you can read their books or anything like that, they're really, really intriguing. Or get the audiobooks. They're awesome. But they're, you know, the couple who went and performed, you know, these paranormal studies and stuff. Well, the universe is going to be based off, is taken to be able to get a little more liberty on some of the legends of the stuff that they were involved in, is going to expand on items. Like they're talking about the Annabelle doll, and they're going to do like one of the new films is Annabelle, the creation. So it's the creation of the Annabelle doll that became possessed. They're going to have another one, which is called Nun, which is based off of another character that's been portrayed and seen in The Conjuring 1 and Conjuring 2. What's cool about these is oftentimes they're PG-13, but they scare and jump like a rated R without all the F-bombs and everything else. And they are an actual, if you enjoy being scared, they are good films because they will scare you. But the fact that Universal is able to expand so broadly within all the stories that the Warrens have, because they have a room full of knickknacks and stuff that are haunted objects or possessed or demonized objects that they can draw from any of those elements and then go and do a backstory on. And as long as people are willing to buy into it, then they have a full library of interesting and unique content, as opposed to, hey, we're watching a Wolfland movie, or hey, we're watching something that's been retread upon. This is all stuff that's its own story.
Yeah, and they need to do it properly too. It's a highly successful financially horror franchise, highly successful. And when you start doing this universe like this, and you start going back and forth and jumping all over the place and doing stuff simultaneously, you do need a strong puppet master in charge of that. And we've seen that in terms of cinematic universes, the difference between Kevin Feige over at Marvel and Geoff Johns at DC. The quality is with Feige, not Geoff Johns. And we've seen that in the quality of the movies. You need a puppet master to control all these things and make sure the quality comes out good. You see that in small restaurant chains that are locally. If you have one good chef making sure it's all good, it's going to come out right. If you pass it on to five chefs, then most likely you're not going to get good quality and all that stuff.
You're not going to get the same flavor profile.
Exactly.
But yeah, so, exactly.
Yep. So I think that's going to have one of the biggest parts to do with it is who's actually dangling.
Pulling the strings.
Threads down there. Pulling the strings, yeah.
Yeah. Next up, we have another character joining the Rampage arcade game movie, which this could be fun, but when they talk about it, he talks about he's playing an agent. And this, we're talking about Jeffrey Dean Morgan, Negan himself, is joining the Rampage, and he's playing a cocky, full of himself agent, opposed to the Dwayne Johnson character, which is supposed to be saving the world. What I heard when I read about this is basically, yeah, I feel like it's an expansion of Negan. It, like, instantly I hear it, I'm like, okay, it's Negan, although he's not going to probably have a baseball bat beating people's heads in. But it just sounds like he's playing the same character.
But when he stands up, will he lean back 30 degrees when he talks? If he does, then he's really bringing the Negan. If he's standing straight up, he's not bringing the Negan. He has to do that 30-degree lean back and then talk, and then that's your true Negan right there.
Okay, okay. Yeah.
But I like this cast. I mean, right now,
yeah.
Right now we have Rock, we have Jeffrey Dean Morgan, we have Malin Ackerman, Joe Manganiello is in it as well. God, I can never pronounce his name properly. So yeah, we got a
stripper werewolf.
Good cast in it. It's this could be fun. I'll leave it out there. It's a long ways in the future. It's April 2018. It could be fun.
They just, you know, that's what they just have to hit on. They have to target to be fun. And if they come at this with the same way that they're coming at Baywatch, then I think that they'll hit on the cylinders that they need to hit in order for it to be successful.
Yep, that's exactly what I was going to say. Because when people told me they're making a Baywatch movie, I was like, ha! But the only reason I'm taking this Rampage thing with any grain of seriousness that it could be good is because that Baywatch movie looks freaking funny and entertaining. And I never would have thought that in a million years. So there you go.
So we're talking about a movie where a bunch of monsters just punch out windows, right?
And eat hamburgers.
Okay. So there's no way on God's green earth that this movie is worth a damn. More than the fact.
So what's the basic premise of Baywatch? A bunch of pretty people saving people. How does that look good? And it is because you take it, you put a twist in it, you put some extra twist in it where it makes fun of itself, and you add a whole bunch of humor into it, and
you throw in Rock and Zac Efron.
I'm calling it now.
Younger crowd and an older.
I'm calling it now though. On Baywatch, the main villain is Hasselhoff.
Don't hassle the Hoff.
The Hasselhoff is the villain. I'm calling it.
If a Hasselhoff is the villain, I might actually watch. If he's in drunk rage.
Eating a burger.
Which is not even acting. It's like just really who he is. So like if he just does that, I'll watch.
Should we say this?
Kind of off topic question for you guys. Do you think the nostalgia is just kind of going rampant? Out of control
a little bit, but I like it. I like it. It's you know, every so many, it's like seems like every 20 years this happens.
I agree, Brandon, that it is out of control but it right now it sells. Like, remember people say like this sells, action sells, gore right. sells. Oh, after the Saw and Ring stuff, horror.
I mean
sells,
really, you got the NES sells. Mini came out, and Stranger Things came out, and. From there, it just kind of just snowballed into everything.
I mean, we talked earlier about a video game that's bringing back the platformer, you know? So, I mean, it is. People are going towards the old, but true, it's something that they can bring in, and it is. It's all marketing, but, you know, it's enjoyable, at least, for the most part.
South Park did an entire season just on this. And this is exactly what it was about. It was just making fun of everything in 2016 that was hitting on the nostalgia feels in every aspect of our life. And it is continuing now because people are still buying it. And it will hit critical mass. Because that's the thing about when you when you can make any movie you want right now. There is no regulation on what you can make. People will continue making it until the nostalgia flops.
They're not making new things.
Hitting back and forth.
They're reflecting back to old stuff that they've already done over and over again. Granted, it's nicer now with, you know, better graphics, better technology, but
Hunger Games. I mean,
even the new, that's what I'm saying. Even the new Halloween film is going to go back to the original two that were took place on the same day, and they're adding that third in. I mean, it's just going to be called Halloween 3, which is actually cool, but it's playing on nostalgia.
Why do new IPs not do as successful as repeat games? Because people will follow an Assassin's Creed 2 over a Sunset Overdrive. They go to things that they know and that are comfortable versus things that they don't know. So it's going to continue that. You're going to continue to see things that are retreads because, A, you pull the original people that are in it, and then you pull their kids because we're doing it, we're stretching it long enough that now that we're hitting on a 10-year to 15-year gap, they've had children. Hey, I remember when this was cool. You should come and watch it with me. Let's go to the movies together. And so that's who you're pulling in. So this is going to continue for a bit.
It's true. I mean, it works. That's what one thing has been, you know, one of the first things that drew my oldest son and I got into was he got into Aliens and Predator universe, and he's cannot wait for Alien Covenant, you know? And so that's just, you know, that's just how it goes.
Sorry to derail the hype train, guys. It was just like bugging me. I had to ask that question. Are we ready to head back in time and go into This Week in Geek?
Hey, Doc, we better back up. We don't have enough road to get up to 88.
Roads? Well, we're going. We don't need roads.
So on April 1st, 2004, the new ubiquitous Gmail service is launched as an invitation-only beta service. At first met with skepticism due to it being launched on April Fool's Day, the ease of use and the speed of Gmail offered for the web-based email service quickly won converts. The fact that Gmail was an invitation-only for a long time helped fuel the mystique, and for those that use the email address were able to be hip and uber-cool, and those who actually were the hip and uber-cool, of course, are those types of things that didn't bother the hip and uber-cool. So, like, we know that Gmail initially had some hiccups. But people were into it, and now, I mean, today, at this point, if you have Gmail, like, everybody has a Gmail.
Oh, yeah. April 3rd, 1973, Martin Cooper, considered the father of the cellular phone, makes the first cell phone call on a New York City street.
I wonder if it was on a Zach Morris phone, because I'm super curious.
Brick phones. Oh, yeah. Oh, the big brick phones.
It was on a brick.
It was on it? Nice.
It was on a brick.
Nice.
Huge, huge phone.
April 4th, 1975, Microsoft is founded as a partnership between Bill Gates and Paul Allen in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The company is founded.
I was going to say they were babies.
19 and 22. Although they were.
I mean, Jesus. Holy hell.
Look at the tech companies nowadays. Look at you guys in Silicon Valley. All that stuff. All these guys.
Yeah. Like 13, 14.
Young guys go in there. Yeah.
Bastards. So,
the company was founded to develop BASIC for MIT's Altair 8800 and MIT's headquartered in Albuquerque. So Gates and Allen moved there from Boston to launch their company. MIT, this must be a different laboratory than the MIT's.
MITS.
MITS?
Yeah, MITS. There's an S on the end.
Oh, okay.
See, they eventually moved to Seattle.
Not reading it right.
Yeah, they moved to
Seattle. It's like the third or fourth week in a row that you haven't read the This Week in Geek, right? Whether it's a date
or
something
else. It says MIT right there. Somehow. There's a three. MIT. It does have an S on the end.
Let's end this cast on a high note. Let's find out where we can find Damian Nash at.
You can find me at Mr. Damian Nash on Twitter. And, God damn you. I was going to say.
Two Fs, two Us, two Cs, two Ks.
Minus the T for character restrictions.
Why?
For character restrictions.
Yo, okay. So you.
for the listeners at home, we've actually started using a new program called Appear.in for our chatting service, and Mr. Cage Saint just decided to pop up the deal with it sticker. So it was very appropriate.
Okay. You can find find me at Mr. Damien Dash, all one word, on Twitter. Also, Manny the Geekologist Twitter, minus T for character restrictions. And you can find my most recent article on Rectified Gaming, which just happens to be about ukulele. And you can delve a little deeper into that and the history behind the development team behind that.
Fantastic. Where can we find you at, Brandon?
You can find me on Twitter at @BE_FOUTZ. And right here, editing the crap out of this podcast.
Of course you can. There's always edits to be had. Cajun, where can you
find this week. We were flawless this week. Especially myself. Especially towards the end.
Flawless.
Yep. So you can find me at Caucasian Saint, all one word, on Twitter. And you can find me right here on this great podcast, weekly, talking about all the awesome stuff in geek culture, in my queue, in my gaming systems, and riding that hype train. And then when I get to the past, I lose it.
He can't find his way to the present.
Done for.
He's done. He is done. My name is Christopher. You can find me at Two Wolves, TWOWOLVZZ, on Twitter, Facebook, any type of gaming. I've got some articles up in lots of places. I've been on hiatus, but I am going to be back in the game this week, actually, now that I have an arm that works. For Geekologist Radio and the rest of the fellas, we are Yowt.